This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The year is 1984, and Hollywood Boulevard never looked grungier as it did in this notorious exploitation classic that dared to do the unforgivable: be successful at the box office. We follow 15-year-old Molly Stewart, honor roll student by day and Hollywood Boulevard sex worker by night. But Molly isn't alone. She has found herself a family of social outcasts and colorful weirdos in the world of street performers, prostitutes, slumlords, and beat cops. When a serial killer begins taking out his trauma-induced violent tendencies out on the sex workers of Los Angeles, Molly and all those looking after her fight back in Robert Vincent O'Neill's Angel. Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Okay, so, you know me, I like to bring some trashiness, some grunginess every once in a while, but it's not like Blame It on Rio debacle, where we, you know, both were aware of what we were getting into with that movie. So dare I say that I think that Angel, the story of a 15-year-old Hollywood Boulevard prostitute, is actually a classier film than Blame It on Rio?
You're not wrong. This is a movie that really is the Febreze on top of the trash, but at the same time, it brings a sweetness to it. So this one is a movie that actually treats the material right.
I'm so happy to hear you say that because, I mean, this is one of those movies. I remember it was one of the very first blogs that I wrote on the website years ago where I was like, did Robert Vincent O'Neill kind of fuck up and make a good movie by mistake? Because that's how it feels. It feels like this should be just like that grindhouse, straight-to-video, sleazy, grimy Hollywood Boulevard type flick, which it is on the surface. But what it does do is it lets us into this world of colorful characters that are a lot of fun, and it makes us have like an empathy for this young girl who's trapped in this world of sex work so she can get good grades in school during the day and go to a good college. On paper, it doesn't really make sense, but in performance and in delivery by the director, the screenwriter, and everyone involved, damn it, it actually works really well, in my opinion.
It works well because this isn't the standard movie that we'll get time over time over time again, where we look at just the pure ugliness of the streets. And I don't want to be taken out of context saying that in no way am I saying that this is the right way of work, or I promote prostitutes or any of that. But I do want to say that this is where they get it right, because it shows this young girl and the streets. They actually support her in wanting to see her succeed and make the right decisions. We've talked about this before. This one is a movie that really does have the supporting cast written well to really support our Molly character, to really want to care about the outcome. And it's one of those rare movies that just doesn't focus, again, on the ugliness, but the community of it, if I want to call it that, is the bound to care for one another, where they're out on the street. You have this underage girl, you have these colorful characters, and they're all coming together for one united reason, and that's to see Molly taken care of. And that's one of the biggest attractions to this movie. It's not the sex, it's not the prostitution, it's not the street grunge, it's the actual sympathy and empathy of our characters.
Yes, and the fact that we are very carefully handling the subject matter, and we're very carefully handling the idea of like no one really wants this girl doing this, but they know that they're not able to stop her. So the best thing they can do is protect her. And that's what I really love about the community of this movie. We've seen communities like this in other films and other genres. You know, I think Nightmare Alley is a good example of, like, you know, you've got the carnival people that all kind of protect each other from the community, because it's usually the community and the people that want to exploit them that are the bad ones. These are just vagabonds that are going from town to town, just scraping together a living, doing, you know, mind tricks or geek shows and things like that. I always love that kind of like underbelly of society type narrative where you realize that there's a lot more good in those communities than the so-called nice communities, right? The nice boys at high school are actually the toxic and villainous ones. They are the ones that I would be more afraid of meeting in a dark alley than any of the people that Molly hobnobs with. And I think that's the thing that really makes this movie work great, because it is handled with a mature hand and a mature eye, where it is exploitation on the surface, but it is genteel underneath it. But the characters, the way they were written and the way they are performed and the way that they are almost drawn out in front of our very eyes is what really makes us feel at home in this movie. Like, I want to hang out with Dick Shawn and Susan Tyrell and play cribbage. Like, there's just a warmth to these people, even though they're bitter, they're kind of nasty to each other, they're sarcastic, I love, like, putting down the squares, but they're watching each other's back, and I just love all of that.
I love that you mentioned the surface level of the subject matter, because the subject matter here is handled very well. Now, on the surface, yeah, you're going to have an underage prostitute, whatever it may be, but it doesn't make it the focal point. It doesn't make it really exploitation. And we'll hear that with our critics in a bit. And I 100% disagree with that aspect, because there is a lot more to this movie than what the eye shows. And we'll see it through the dialogue of these characters, the actual empathy they show towards Molly. We spend more time with this film on building chemistry and building the relationship than we do anything sexual or suggested sexual actions. And that's where this movie really does succeed, is building relationships. And when we take a young girl in her teenage years, this is the prime where we really need to see what road she's going to take. And we kind of do see it in the two spinoffs, the two sequels that we get to an extent. But this is where we really do see her grow. And I do have some flaws with the Molly character, because to me, I don't find her as interesting, of course, as the supporting characters. I do think that there is a bigger forte with the supporting characters than Molly. But to me, that's okay, because at the end of the day, this is just a teenage girl and she shouldn't outperform the rest of the cast. But there is a problem I have with her trying to carry the movie to the climax, where we really spend too much time almost with her. And I wanted to see more of the supporting characters really drive her to a pivotal character arc to see where she goes. And we really don't get that with the Molly character.
What it is, and is what we talked about, but in reverse. We've talked about how we do not like it when supporting characters take over the movie when they're really trying to push that main character, if they're a famous actor or someone they're trying to push into the limelight, and they're just not interesting, but all the side characters are. That can be a detriment to your movie. But this, I feel, is actually constructed that way, where Molly actually is supposed to be a little bit dull and a little bit boring, right? The idea is that Molly is, I'm going to make the weirdest analogy here. Molly's Wilbur from Charlotte's Web, right? She is just that character that's like in danger, is not old enough, mature enough, wise enough to be able to take care of herself. Therefore, all the interesting characters have to like build her up, make her feel more important, and cover for her when she needs to be covered for. Even though it's like illegal in every sense of the word, but that's what they're there for. They're there to make the magic web so Molly is safe. She is the Wilbur. It's a weird analogy, I know, but that's the only way I could think of describing it, where Wilbur's not an interesting character. Molly, the interestingness of her character is what she's doing for money and how she's living these dual lives, how she's just very under the radar in high school because that's what she wants. She doesn't want to be the popular girl. She just wants to get her grades and get out. And she doesn't want anyone to know what she is doing with her evenings. And, you know, that does happen, and she has to face the consequences of that. So, yeah, I think that the first film, 100%, it is intentional that Molly is supposed to be the save the cat. She is the driving point for all the other characters to come together, and they're fascinating. So Dick Shawn as May, like, that is a fantastic character. The first episode that you and I ever did together was The Producers, and we talked about him as LSD, and one memorable performance there and another memorable performance here. You know me, I'm already a Susan Tyrell fan. She kills it in this one as Solly, the slumlord, who the eyebrows, man. Like, I don't know. I have no proof, but I feel like that's just the way she showed up. She's like, this is me today, guys. Let's shoot.
100%. And this is where I think there's a real kind of attraction to the way these two interact when we look at Dick Shawn. Because this chemistry is where this banter is that hard street life that they really do amplify in this one scene. That's one of my favorite scenes where they're sitting there playing a game that leads to May's climax. And the moment we see Solly really go up there and just see the shock of reality is a really heartfelt moment where we don't really go over dramatic with it. We keep it real with the reality of what these two are really facing when it comes to what's happening to May. And to me, that was a very powerful scene. And it's one of those scenes I had to really think about because at a first watch, I absolutely hated it because I loved this May character so much. And yeah. I think it could have been a lot more. But at the same time, in reflection, this is what needed to happen because it would have thrown off the movie to give us anything different. So it's a underwhelming but perfect ending to May in this one scene that really does show the dangers of the street. But I think what really threw off that scene was the killer that I'm sure we'll get into in a second.
Yeah, because the killer, it's not necessarily like the driving force of the movie. The driving force of the movie is the characters. The killer and his whole plot progression, I love that it's not just like a mindless thing. We actually get a lot of insight into like why he does the things he does. But not to the point where it becomes his movie. It's very cleverly written. Like the way that they're able to allow us to follow three different storylines, right? We got the street people, we've got Molly, and then we got the killer. And never do we feel oversaturated in either of them. In fact, like you said, there's times where I feel like I wanted more of these characters. And I think that's really wise too, because May essentially represents the mother figure that Molly needs so much. But Molly can't always rely on a mother figure, so we have to get ourselves out of that bottleneck of storytelling and of plot so Molly can become more self-reliant. And that's where I think Cliff Gorman as Lieutenant Andrews comes in, because he is the cop that's like putting prostitutes in jail every night, but then he sees a charity case, essentially. He sees what he doesn't want a 15-year-old girl to have to go through because he's seen it before. And he realizes that he's underestimated her because she's a smart girl. She's going to school. She's not on the needle. She's not doing this because it's the only thing. She has a plan to get out. And in his mind, he's like, okay, well, let me just get her out the best way I can and the safest way I can. And he becomes like a paternal side to her. It really goes with the undertones of the movie where it's like the father abandoned her and the mother years ago, and she's waiting for him to come back. And then the mother abandons her. She's abandoned by both. And so in turn, she has these two surrogates, right? She's got the lieutenant and then she's got May. And I think the part of the story that's so amazing to me in its writing, its progression, is the fact that she doesn't get to keep either of them. And it just, into the sequels, which aren't as good, but I still think they're quite entertaining, it really shows like the progression of her character. Because in the second two movies, she's not a prostitute. She actually is a successful person that goes back into the disguise of a prostitute to uncover crime and, you know, connect with lost loved ones. But it's interesting that like she's only a prostitute when she's 15, and then she gets out of it and like becomes almost like a Batman, essentially, of street crime and saving prostitutes.
I love the progression of the sequels where it just goes into almost cliche territory, but at the same time, you're right.
It goes into Rambo 3 is what it does. Yeah.
Right, just looking at the cover of Angel 3 and the title of the final chapter has nothing to do with the original material. But you're absolutely right. When it comes down to these characters, it's... Now, Molly is smart, and we do get that. I think the most memorable scene to me is when, or the first example, is when she's in the cop car and she can identify a cop. Now, kind of teetering around the sleaze element, but it's not, because it's self-identifying what she needs to do to survive. It's survival mode. It's street smarts. And this is what the movie really seeks out to do, to really show the level of intelligence of our Molly character. Is she is going to school to better the book smarts, but at the same time, she's developing the real important aspect of where she's at, which is the street smarts. And to me, I'm going to say this probably a couple more times, is the school aspect of it. I would have loved to see more, but I completely understand it. It would derail the movie of what the messaging is trying to do, is to give us this example of the survival mode of street smarts with this young girl and how this girl is raised. And you can almost go to a more of an in-depth level of judging these characters, from the rootin' tootin' sheriff to
Kit Carson.
Yeah. All of these people have these moments of teaching Molly something new. And this is where the movie stays fresh and the pacing is spot on, because these are characters we want to get more of. And we don't need a huge backstory, but we do get hints of previous lives that really does amplify in Molly's personality as we see her develop throughout the movie. And that's what I really did appreciate. They don't just throw in these characters to throw in characters. There's a rhyme and reason, and they're great performances to really want to follow and connect the dots between how Molly progresses towards the end of the climax.
Well, and with the high school things, which you were saying about, I think that what's brilliant about that, and even like the beginning montage, essentially, of her walking the streets and, you know, seeing the Johns kind of drive by and pick up, and they're all like middle class, upper middle class dudes. It really speaks to like the duality of man, right? Where she is safer with her band of weirdos on the street than she is at school with these, you know, predatory boys who they're going to shame her, yet the very next day they're out on the street looking for women just like her. That's totally intentional. And it's intentional, too, of like some of the dialogue of these Johns as they drive by. I think it's very intuitive in the sense of they don't look at these people on the street as humans. They look at them as property. They look at them as objects. Yet at home, they are going to be, oh, I am the nicest man. Look at my family. Look what I've built. You know, they really speak to that. Like, this is who their clientele is, where the strongest sense of family and belonging is this group of people that she's found. And so that is why when they do introduce the killer element to it, the closest women in her lives, her fellow streetwalkers, are getting taken out one by one. And it brings almost like a horror element into the movie, where now we have comedy, we have action, we have drama, we have horror. What do we have the least of? Sexuality and sensuality. We've got some gratuitous shower nudity, which is just typical of any film. I just watched just one of the guys before I got on here with my partner. She'd never seen it. I'm like, oh, there's gratuitous shower scenes in that too, not to mention the ending. So don't get on your soapbox that Angel is an overly sexually aggressive movie, because it is not. In fact, I think it is the contradictory notion of that, where look at the poster, look at the idea of what the movie is, look at the plot. It's not what you think it is, and that's the brilliance of it. You're going in for one story, and then you're finding yourself enjoying the story that's actually giving you, which is, like we've talked about, a genteel story at heart.
It's the idea of assumption. People take the subject matter of what the premise is, and they're going to just stick to that and think it's sleaze. And again, subject matter on the surface level, absolutely, a young prostitute. It's hard to have the human ears listen to that main sentence, is a young underage girl prostituting. Yes, it's shocking. but that doesn't stop somebody from watching what the vision is going to be or where the journey is going to take you. And this is appropriately done because to kind of even back in the 80s to even now, this isn't something that doesn't happen. And the way it is absolutely handled shouldn't be sugarcoated, but at the same time, this is a movie that does show hope for building relationships or not being shut out, because we do see young girls that go to this business for much same reasons to even worse reasons. But this one actually does give a ray of hope of building that relationship to those that do have experience, that does have life experience, to really amplify who you are as a person, to really grow oneself, to not just stick in the same business. Because the overlaying message is, you're right, Molly doesn't want to do this. She admits this in the movie. And that is a powerful statement and a good point that even overshadows the main synopsis of this movie. Is I don't want to do this. And that is a bigger message to take away than just reading a 2-sentence synopsis and calling it trash.
I wonder how lucky Robert Vincent O'Neill felt while he was filming this movie and directing these actors. Because his other movie, Vice Squad, which is very similar in theme in the sense of these are the grungy streets of LA. We're dealing with pimps and prostitutes and drug dealers. And it's played more for like the shock and camp factor. You know, Wings Hauser is the villain. He's amazing in it. But that is exactly what I would expect from that particular story. But with this one, man, I tell you, the performances, especially Susan Tyrell, Dick Shawn, Elaine Griftos is the teacher, and then John Deal is the killer. When you're watching these scenes, like, you know you're watching a low-budget grindhouse movie, but there is a prestige to these performances that is almost shocking. The scene that you mentioned, the final moments between Sully and May, like the emotions in that scene, they're shot stagey, right? It's shot with like a very low budget kind of B movie framing, but it doesn't matter because the emotions coming out of the performers, it's almost like, well, I'm glad they're not flying the camera all over the place because I want to spend this moment with these people. That is one of the things that makes this movie stand out so much, is that every performance is spot on. I forgive some of the goofiness of the high school stuff because it doesn't matter. In fact, I think it plays to the idea of high school isn't real. You know, this is not real life. This is not even preparing you for real life. You're not going to learn anything in the halls of these buildings that's going to help you in the real world. You're going to get hurt outside, and that's where you're going to learn from. And I think that is almost intentional, where like the high school scenes do feel a little bit goofy, and that's perfectly fine because the streets is where all the action takes place, and that's where all the real emotions are. And yeah, the other performance that it's very small but also very memorable for me is that of Stephen M. Porter as Yo-Yo. He's the Yo-Yo street performer who has a crush on the one prostitute. He's only in it for like the first 15 minutes, but his breakdown scene, when he's at the house where the prostitute was murdered, I was like, this is like a throwaway character, and I'm getting like emotional right now, especially when he has the little ball in his hand, right? I'm like, oh my God, and it's covered in blood. There's a lot more going on in this movie than I think any of the contemporary critics, save a couple, gave it credit for.
You know a character is successful when you get into the sequel and that's the you see the character and you just smile because you're glad to see him because he is an impactful character. He's a likable character. And the screen time that he does have, it's well utilized to have this likability to it where you do want more.
Yeah.
And honestly, we want more from all these characters. And what I really did appreciate, and I'm glad you brought up the shot of May's demise, is it would have been so easy to just fast forward this reel to make it look like it's action-packed. It's more hectic than what it is. Mm-hmm. And they don't go that route because they do spend a lot more time. They keep it real with real choreographed, if I were to call it choreographed, or just tearing up a room and wrestling. But they keep it really real and raw when it comes to it. It doesn't. It's not manipulated in any way. And we do, to an extent, have that vision that that the vision is wanting to spend more time with these characters. And at first, and I think I watched this scene a few times because it was impactful that we really do don't appreciate it with the first viewing of what we're seeing. We kind of think it's B movie. It's not shot well, but then we start to open up that that's the intent and it's appreciated by the time you actually watch it a couple times.
I agree. Like this movie gets better every time I watch it. And I've been watching this movie for like over 20 years and it does get better every single time. And cinematically, I think one of the things I really respect about it is that they don't, and probably because of budgetary reasons, I love that the movie uses tons of master shots, right? Because there's so many characters in the streets of Hollywood Boulevard that we don't get dialogue from, but the fact that they are in the shot, it makes us want to know their stories. Yes, we're going to spend time getting to know Yo-Yo and May and Solly and all these people, but like when a prostitute dies or if they're getting picked up by the police or if they're at their regular hangout spot or talking to Kit Carson, the master shots where they allow Hollywood Boulevard to be a character itself, where you get to read the marquees on theaters and all like the strip joints and the little, you know, nude arcades, that's a character. And then all of the people there watching this and all the other street performers, those are characters that are just kind of symbiotic to the environment. And I felt like if you were doing tons of close shots and not capturing all of that in your frame, then you're doing yourself a disservice of building this world that the story operates in.
O'Neill is very smart here because my biggest pet peeve is having up close shots to really try and attempt to capture emotions. And this isn't necessarily a drama per se. Like you said, it covers multiple genres. And to have the scene really engulf, it affects not only creating its own character of the atmosphere, but it also affects the chemistry of how everybody interacts. It paints a picture of the imagination to really put us into the environment to watch how these characters react. It's almost the once upon a time where we get, we set the scene and then the characters go into it. And we don't see that anymore. And again, that is one of my favorite pieces of it is setting the scene. Instead of just going all in, let's focus on these two characters, do some up close shots, pull back a little bit, and that's our chemistry. This one is at the root of, and I, you mentioned something earlier where if this was an accidental success from
good movie.
Yeah. And to me, it almost seems that way. But at the same time, there is some intent here where somebody just doesn't walk in the street. The easiest intention is to do up close shots, especially when we're capturing chemistry. And we don't go that route. So I think this one was intentional by O'Neill to really create what his vision was with this, not to create another sleaze picture, but have those undertones that it's still present.
And that's one of the things that Cannon tried to capture for years with Charles Bronson movies, right? Especially towards the end when he was doing like Murphy's Law and 10 to Midnight and Kinjite, they're sleazy LA movies. But I think where they don't match the majesty of this one is that they don't allow the city to be a character. And this tells you right away what you're doing. Like that opening tracking shot of her, and it's handheld and it's jittery, but following her as we're going onto Hollywood Boulevard, it's a shot they use in the trailer, and it shows the streets and the buses and the cabs, and it just does a pan to the right and shows all of Hollywood Boulevard. That is your opening the door to Oz shot in Wizard of Oz. And I love it because it's simple, but it knows exactly what it's doing. Like, this is the world we're telling our story in. And it's one of my favorite opening shots of all time, I think, because paired with the music, paired with the nighttime atmosphere and the noise, you can almost smell the city. It just works so well.
Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show. Okay, so now let's get into our reviews. Now, this is one that Gene brought to the show, and Gene didn't like it.
Angel is a trashy exploitation film about a teenage prostitute that has turned out to be a surprising box office success wherever it's played, making millions of dollars. It's the story of a young girl living two very different lives, an all-ace high school student by day and a teenage prostitute on Hollywood Boulevard at night.
So he's just kind of going through like the basic motions of it, but the fact that he's calling it trash, that is the bait and switch, right? Because that's the way it presents itself. It presents itself as trash, and you really have to sit and watch and absorb to understand that, like, it's not. It's actually using the trash as the cheese to get you into the story, and you find yourself overwhelmed. I remember seeing this movie when I was, like, 15 or 16, and that's exactly the same way I feel now about it. It was like, I watched this for boobs, right? I watched this because it's about like a sex story or prostitutes. Like, I was thinking this was going to be something total exploitation, right? And then you realize that, oh no, this is actually a good movie. He just goes off on a bad attitude about it. And I think I can never let it go, the fact that he gave Blame It on Rio a thumbs up, and then he's calling a picture like this trash. And I'll say it once again, this is classier than Blame It on Rio.
A year later, he liked Blame It on Rio compared to this movie. just a year. People can change that quick, because this one is probably the most contradictory piece of Gene Siskel, because this one does have some messaging. It does have some characters. And Blame It on Rio had none of the chemistry, none of the characters. It just had nudity, boobs, no atmosphere, no real utilization of the setting. Blame It on Rio did the opposite of what this movie did, and this is what's trash. So this, listening to the opening statement of Gene Siskel on this one drove me nuts. Whether he had an epiphany that he's just totally open to watching trash after this movie, who knows? But this one, he gets it completely wrong on the main trash aspect, and this is where critical thinking really is missing in this review, is it's not rocket science on the messaging here if you pay attention. So this isn't advanced filmmaking when it comes to how you're delivering your vision. So I think my 13-year-old daughter can watch this movie and take away something from this movie that Gene didn't.
Agreed. He goes on.
I thought Angel was trash despite its attempt to win our hearts with Angel's story of how her mother's dead and she was abandoned by her father, and how she is hooking until her dream comes true and her father comes back home. She's been waiting for him for 5 years, of course. Of course, this film can't just stay with Angel's sad story. That would be too classy. There's a mad slasher in Hollywood cutting up all the hookers, so we get a little sex and violence. And we get needless scenes of Angel's classmates in their high school showers. What does that have to do with anything? And then there's Angel's friends, an old Hollywood cowboy played campily by Rory Calhoun, and a transvestite played by Dick Shawn. Angel is junk.
Okay, so I have another analogy. I think I have to go back to Boogie Nights, where Jack Horner, played by Burt Reynolds, talks about how he wants to make the best porno ever made, where he wants to make the story so intriguing that if a guy goes into a porno theater, he just has to sit in it and watch the whole story. He's not just going to jerk off and leave. Now, I'm not saying that this was the bait and switch that they're trying to do with this film, but I can understand what he's talking about, because he went into this movie with that mindset. And he did not recognize the fact that that was the intent of the filmmaker. It's like, you think you're going to come see an exploitive skin flick, because that's what all of these B movies were at that time, right? It's what Canon was making. It's what New World Pictures was making. This was going to be something different. And I guarantee you that there were people who went into the film expecting that, and then left going like, oh my God, I just watched a damn good movie. Honey, I went and saw Angel, right? And it was good.
you can tell with Siskel, when he amplifies the word hookers, there is an amount of anger there, of pure disappointment, where he went in wanting to see some hookers. He wanted to see a movie about maybe not the sexual nature of the streets, but he went in wanting what the synopsis probably promised, which is this grungy, this underworld, whatever it may be. He wasn't expecting something of substance. And he is too hard-headed, I think, to really admit it, on that he took something away from it. But I think as we learn and we get on with this show, that we're starting to learn that Gene really does have a problem with almost the bait and switch of how a movie is marketed and what he walks out of the theater receiving. So it could be a good movie.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. But if it's promised something different, he will tear it apart just out of principle, is what it comes across.
And it's not just any particular genre. We've seen him do it with horror movies. We've seen him do it with the Ghostbuster clones, he likes to call them. We've seen him do it with science fiction. Like, he does not like genre bending, is what I've decided. He wants to have, it's such a binary way to think, where it's like, if I want my drama to be a drama, it's got to be a genre, and it can't be funny, and it can't be sexy. It has to be just this. Like, it's true. I'm not saying he doesn't appreciate good cinema, because again, that's subjective. I really think that he is just so locked into his biases that he doesn't want a film to genre bend. He doesn't want a film to try and be campy and funny at the same time. I mean, like, he really tore apart the Guilty Pleasures episode. Was an interesting one where he brought some films that we were really surprised because they're exactly the thing that he hates. I think it was on repeat viewings that he finally was like, okay, I'm going to give this a pass. I'll watch it again. But even then, his picks were nowhere near as fun as Roger's. And speak of the devil, Roger comes in to, like, save the day.
Angel is not junk. I'm surprised that you didn't like this film. It had a lot of energy in it.
You may be surprised. I'm going to be shocked if you continue along this line.
This movie is an exploitation film. You're right about that. But it also has a lot of energy. It has very interesting character performances by Roy Calhoun, who isn't camp at all. He's a very straight Western cowboy. By Dick Shawn, who is camp. He's a transvestite, and that's a very interesting performance.
Interesting. All he walks around in is in a dress.
Oh, and also creates a very interesting character, a three-dimensional character there, and his relationship with this young girl. Kind of like.
Did you think the killer was an interesting character?
Killer was a very interesting character. Cliff Gorman, the guy who played Lenny in the movie Lenny is a very good detective in this film.
You're making me want to see Lenny again.
Okay, fine. Lots of good performances. A real interesting look at this sleazy side of Hollywood Boulevard. Not as exploitation in terms of the sex and violence as a lot of other films I've seen. Mm-hmm. A real attempt to do something interesting on a low budget. I think you're being unfair to it.
And I agree 100%.
I agree, but 99%. And again, the only thing I didn't like about Roger's statement is that he led giving Gene a little nugget saying that he agrees it's an exploitation film. No, it's an idea of exploitation. It's not an exploitation film. So that would be the only thing that I would clarify with that. But Roger just nails it and part of that 99% would be also the killer. I still don't find 100% interesting. He's there. He's moving the story along. I get it. He's there for pivotal moments, but he doesn't have enough to make him interesting. So those are the two elements I'm going to disagree with Roger, but everything else he absolutely nails. Because we've talked about it just now. All the characters are extremely interesting. They're three-dimensional. They're likable. And we want to follow them for the runtime. Watching these characters make this movie feel a lot shorter than what it really is. And that is a great sign of just engulfing us into this movie.
No, I see what you're saying about the killer. I particularly think that it's a really great example of the less is more strategy when you're trying to explain the modus operandi of a killer without having to spend 20 minutes outside of your main story to do it. All they do with this killer is they show him scrubbing himself down after he's killed a prostitute, and it just shows a picture of him as a child next to his mother. And it's a very unhappy child and an unhappy mother. That's the only explanation we get of his background, of his history, and of his trauma. But I think between just his facial expression and the close-up of that picture, it tells us enough. It lets us know that this is a maternal-driven desire to kill. What I hated about the Red Dragon movie that Brett Ratner did is that he gave us so much exposition of why the Tooth Fairy was the Tooth Fairy. That takes all of the mystery out of it. That takes all of the scares out of it. Michael Mann's was much better because they get us to like him enough
as he's going into this relationship with Joan Allen, but they don't delve way too deep into why the way he is. They do in the book, and that's fine. That's what books are for. This is a goddamn movie, right? Keep it tight. You don't have to tell me another story that takes me out of the energy. So I like the fact that they gave us just enough to know that there was something going on with this guy, and that fleshes him out a little bit more than just leaving him a cold-hearted killer with no explanation whatsoever. So I'll give him credit for that. I agree with you. It's not super interesting, but they didn't just throw the idea away that this guy was killing with no modus operandi.
Well, it almost begs the question for me after watching it, was the killer even necessary if we're using this less or more? Because that movie has so many things going for it. Even when we reached the climax, I kind of just shrugged my shoulders and said, this could have been a lot more. This could have gone a couple different directions. So to me, I love the less is more strategy. I totally agree with you. But at the same time, there is so many other interesting things happening around this killer that the killer is the least interesting part. I would have much rather seen this chemistry with the characters crescendo into a different direction. We can still have some traumatic elements to it, but there are so many things happening in the streets of a city during this time that didn't necessarily have to go in the cliche of the simple solution of a killer that we have seen time and time again. So to me, I think the killer elements are okay, but I wouldn't go as far as saying it was necessary or interesting for me.
I see that. I mean, she did need some kind of danger conflict other than just being a prostitute, whether it was a killer or what if it was something to do with, you know, like, oh, she's about to lose her scholarship. I don't know. But I think the danger element definitely needs to be there to remind us that Hollywood Boulevard is kind of dangerous. And there's a reason why these people stick together. So I think that a device of danger is necessary. It didn't necessarily have to be a serial killer, but I'm not upset that it was, because it got us where we needed to be for these characters to have their final resolution.
I think you're being the most generous critic to this film in the whole nation. You can have that opinion, but I know of no one else that shares it.
I don't really care what anybody else thinks, just so long as I know that I'm right.
Yeah, well, that's why we have you on the show, as I mentioned once before.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no one has to know as long as I'm right. And he's right. And he's a right more often than he's wrong. He's wrong plenty. But compared to Gene, he does have a lot more recognition for the talent and for the actual intent that filmmakers were trying to present with their films. And this is a perfect example of that. We've covered real shit films on this podcast, and he's called them out for being shit. I think that we had a special place in our heart for them because we like the story. We like the actor, and they're being a little too harsh on, let's say, the filmmaking or the editing, whatever. But at the end of the day, this is a movie that I don't think anyone was expecting to be as good as it was. And I think he recognizes that, and he's not going to take that away from the people behind this. She's Out of Control is a different story. I like She's Out of Control. He didn't. But She's Out of Control was actually supposed to reach a lot wider audience than it did. And I think that's why he disliked it so much, is he disliked all the things that it was trying to say for it being such a movie that was to have the widest range of ages and audiences, where this was written and released for a very specific demographic. Boys, men, teenagers, and you see people dressing up as Angel at Comic-Con now, right? Like, it's become an iconic character, and it's kind of like an iconic movie. It's a cult thing for sure, but it reached an audience and an appreciation that I don't think the filmmakers ever intended.
No, and especially when it comes to She's Out of Control, it's a chaotic comedy with chaotic messaging. I can get and see different aspects of that. So,
right.
But when it comes to this, Roger does get it, and this is where I do really appreciate the statement of, I don't care. I love it when Roger says that, because this is where it really does build his credibility on. He can like a really shitty movie, and we've seen that. We're going to cover a lot more shitty movies that Roger liked. But he doesn't buy into that childish push to say from Gene saying you are the only one that's really going to like this movie, which is an elementary, amateurish way of saying you got to agree with me. That is absolutely not true. And I love the fact that he doesn't even engage in it. It's just, I don't care. This is the man that has no problem standing up at Sundance and say, you are wrong. This is the vision. So this is where one of those Ebert moments that really does put him in a separate category than most critics is he doesn't stay in the background and allow the messaging to go unwelcomed to the other critic. He's not going to have it go unrecognized because this messaging to this movie does need to be recognized or else it just turns into just that, sleaze.
I think to me, why I appreciate this movie so much, because it's really what my show is reflective of, is that there were a lot of films that were put out either on small limited theatrical runs and then found their audience on video or on cable. But there are so many movies out there that I think remain unclaimed and unspoken for in the realms of film criticism, right? Like they weren't deemed worthy enough to spend time to actually watch them and review them on At the Movies and the Siskel and Ebert Show. This is one of those ones that kind of snuck in because it'd be very easy for this to not have made the show. There are films that we want to talk about that never made the show that were a lot more higher in prestige than this one. So I think that this is like the canary in the coal mine where it's like, okay, guys, just because it sleaze on the surface and it's made for a very particular demographic doesn't mean that there aren't redeeming qualities cinematically that Roger recognizes for sure. That's what like half of the movies on my shelf are. It's like, damn, no one watched this when it came out in the theater, and I'm lucky that someone put it on a disc that I can keep until it, you know, fades away or melts or whatever, because you can't find them anymore. And Angel's a weird one because sometimes it's streaming, sometimes it's not. Sometimes the sequel's on there and the original's not. It's always come and go with this movie. So yeah, it's a real interesting look into this genre that was thrown off, you know, people's radar because it was the sleaze exploitation genre. I'm telling you, it's a good movie, and you'd be surprised how charming it is with these characters and how emotional and gripping it can be with its drama, but also with its humor and its charm. It's just, it's an anomaly to me that this movie and this package can get me feeling so many different things and praising it the way that Roger was praising it.
It is a great movie. It is a fantastic feeling watching just from start to finish, just every element from the character chemistry to the outcome. And this is kind of where it really does drive me crazy with a lot of the marketing is when studios really do insult our intelligence, thinking that we really do want sleaze. Sleaze is for a particular market. And again, teenagers, young adults, whatever it may be, to really want to see this movie. But there is a level of intellect that people do want to see something a lot more deeper if we were just challenged in pure honesty of marketing. This movie could have used that angle. And even on the even with Siskel and Ebert, they could have gone in depth on what this movie has for a deeper meaning. But we kind of missed the boat on that one. And to me, that is the most frustrating piece of having this go under the radar of adding something of substance to the marketing to say you're going to get a lot more than just a prostitute, sleaze, and a killer, because there is a lot more to this movie. And I think people need to be challenged a lot more, and they'll be surprised how many people would see a movie like this.
And, you know, I'm not going to say that the sequels are great. I like the sequels fine. They're fun. The second one, I think, is a lot of fun. It's got a lot more characters. And then in the third one, they kind of just go a whole different direction. So you can't have, I'm going to say, like the marathon quality of like a Rocky, you know, 1, 2, and 3, or a Terminator 1, 2, and 3. Like it's like more like that. It progressively gets a little bit more corny and worse. But don't let that take away from how great the first one is. At least they tried to build some kind of a franchise out of it. And eventually it did kind of fall into the realms that we're talking about. It kind of fell into the realms of exploitation, like real exploitation. It happens. It happens when the original writers and directors and stars don't come back and you have to fill in with all these other people, lookalikes, other writers, and you try and capture that energy, but also you're playing for a different market now. You're playing for the video market, the late night cable market, and that is the market where I think Gene is thinking this original film was made for. And I disagree.
I can almost guarantee he probably gave good reviews to the two sequels.
I'm not even sure if they ever made it to theater. I know the third one didn't.
Probably not.
Anyways. Well, I have to say, and I feel like I'm on a run now because I keep giving this guy Fs, but this is an F for me, man. Like, there are so many redeeming qualities to this movie. He could have at least mentioned any of them. And Roger was trying to bait him. He was like, you didn't like this character. You didn't like the story they were trying to tell. You didn't like the fact that they were on an elevated, you know, sense of filmmaking here, that this wasn't just exploitation. He couldn't give it any credit anywhere. And so I give him an F for that.
Completely fair. Spot on. Now, with Ebert, even though I agreed with 99%, there is a missing mark that he had as giving this movie a chance of even more depth to really course correct on what this movie really is. Doesn't do it, but at the same time, he defends it, he promotes it, and he really goes on the defense of this movie being something more. And he focuses on what we really loved about it, which is the characters. So I think with that, it is just enough to squeak by. I give him I'll give him 3 stars on it.
I'd say 3 stars is great. It feels like a 3-star review to me. And the fact that he didn't let Gene push him around, you know, he's like, no, man, like there's a moment where they're not even talking about Angel anymore. They're just talking about, you're a critic. You recognize the good things, right? And that might be contradictory because of how they did treat She's Out of Control, but that was that movie. This is this movie. That's the way I look at it.
100%.
Okay, so next week, it's Justin's pick, and he is choosing a film from the early 90s that I saw in the theater, and I don't know how I feel about it now, so I can't wait to rewatch it. And that is Mel Gibson's Man Without a Face. I believe it's Nick Stahl that's a young boy in that, too, kind of making his film debut, and he went on to have an interesting career as well. I'm just really excited to kind of revisit this because I have a very vivid memory of this time where it's like Mel Gibson put out Forever Young, which was charming, and then followed it right up with this, which is not so charming. So I want to see how the nostalgia goggles work for me when I do my rewatch.
It's been a while for me too. I know in some of our earlier conversations, I brought this one to you, your attention on one of my most interesting watches, I think it was. And again, I haven't watched it in a while, but I'm really curious if it still has that uncomfort that I still felt when I originally watched it.
Yeah, I can't remember it feeling icky. I just remember it feeling down. It's a downer movie. But I also think it's really impressive that directorial-wise, that he took a leap from this into Braveheart in one move. That's pretty crazy to me. That's pretty impressive. So yeah, we'll see how it hangs up. All right, everyone. So thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Please take our recommendation. Go find Angel on streaming. Sometimes it's floating on Tubi. Other times you can find it on the Internet Archive, but it is worth a watch. I highly, highly recommend. And I highly recommend our shows. So please like, review, rate, subscribe, 5 stars, all that good stuff. You can find me and all of my stuff at thecultworthy.com. Justin, where can people find you?
You can find me at themoviewire.com.
Don't forget to visit our sponsor, Bulletproof Coffee. After you're done shopping, jump into your cart, put in the code B, the number 2B, for 20% off, and try and get a little funding to the show so we can pay for internet and stuff like that. Justin, it was a pleasure. I will talk to you later.
See you next week.